This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Historical View, looking back on the people, places, and events of history from yesteryear to ancient history. Facts and stories, large and small, that have influenced our past. Right now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Historical View, and I'm your reader, Kathy Miller, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from BBC History Magazine. Copyright 2025, Immediate Company, London Limited. Volume 26, Issue Number 7. I'm going to start by reading a conversation. Our historian, Matt Hilden, spoke to Rebecca Rist about the politics, controversies, and far-reaching impacts of past papal elections. The Pope doesn't have to be a great theologian, but he has to be in tune with the zeitgeist. In May, the new Pope, Leo XIV, was chosen by the conclave, a secretive gathering of cardinals with a history stretching back many centuries. This conversation starts with Matt Hilden asking, "Can you briefly explain the papal conclave and who's involved?" Rebecca Rist responds, "It's based on the system instituted by Pope Gregory X in the 13th century. After the death of a pontiff, members of the College of Cardinals, a select group of Catholic senior prelates appointed by the Pope and aged under 80, gather from all over the world to elect a replacement. The senior clergy, on whom the choice of the next pope hinges, are sequestered, locked in the Sistine Chapel, conclave derived from cum clave, with a key, until they reach a two-thirds majority vote. White smoke is then sent up to announce to Rome that the new pope has been selected. And he's presented on the Vatican balcony with the words, 'Habemus Papam,' 'We have a pope.'" Matt Elton goes on and asks, "How were popes selected before conclaves were introduced?" Ms. Riss answers, "From the early Middle Ages, German kings and emperors had a hand in this, particularly Holy Roman emperors after Charlemagne. Sometimes popes were acclaimed, put in by the Roman populace and the Roman clergy, and sometimes the Roman aristocracy was most influential. Important families were appointed, such as the Orsini, from whom five popes were appointed between the 8th and 18th centuries, as well as dozens of cardinals. So in certain periods, there were different groups with competing interests, and the appointment of the pope was very much at the mercy of secular powers. The 10th century is often seen as the Nadir, when successive German Holy Roman emperors named Otto installed their choices and pope. That's why pontiffs such as Leo IX and Gregory VII made efforts to break away from secular power, and why in 1059 Pope Nicholas II decided to empower the College of Cardinals as the sole electoral body for popes. Though even after then, some popes, including Gregory VII, and antipopes, were appointed without the cardinals. Which of these popes oversaw significant changes in the church? Leo IX is an interesting case. His papacy began in 1049, and he was effectively appointed by the German Holy Roman Emperor Henry III, who wanted a good reformist pope. In fact, he got rid of three previous popes whom he regarded as useless. Leo oversaw a huge amount of reform of monasticism, which had become very decadent and wealthy, but also attempted to deal with the issue of corruption and bribery, or simony, as it's called in the church. He enforced the idea of celibacy for the clergy, which was never a theological matter, but a rule of the church. Some popes have very bad reputations. Mark Eldon asked, "What can you tell us about them?" Rebecca Rist responds, "Rodrigo di Borgia, known in Italian as Rodrigo Borgia, who took the name Alexander VI when he became pope in 1492, became notorious for supposedly having many mistresses and illegitimate children, though he certainly wasn't the only pope not to stay celibate. He also was accused of having bribed his way to becoming pope. He was elected on the fourth ballot at the conclave, after supposedly giving money to various cardinals for their churches around Rome. However dodgy his election may or may not have been, he was actually a very good administrator. I think he probably realized that he wasn't a great theologian, so he didn't concentrate his efforts there. But he fed the poor of Rome and also allowed in the Jewish people, who had been expelled from the Iberian Peninsula in 1492, an act commemorated on a plaque to Alexander VII in a synagogue in Rome. So popes have obviously been very mixed bags, saints and sinners, as Eamon Duffy famously titled his 1997 book on the history of the popes. Some were great theologians, some were great pastoral leaders, some were less good, but they could have a major say on the direction and image of the papacy through the ages. When we're trying to assess whether popes were bad, for example, in terms of corruption, we need to think about the wider context of the society in which they operated. A king or emperor who made someone a bishop or archbishop in their territories would expect payment, something that, to our modest sensibilities, seems completely wrong today, but which was normal in the medieval world. Earlier, you mentioned the idea of an antipope. What was that? An antipope is someone regarded by the Vatican today as not having been appointed correctly, so not a true successor of St. Peter, regarded as the first pope. At various points in the history of the Catholic Church, there have been multiple claimants to be the rightful pope. In the 11th and 12th centuries, there were no fewer than 15 antipopes, and the problem arose again in the 14th century. This was a period when popes became very much puppets of the French kings. Popes were waging political crusades against the German emperors, and the French kings offered protection to the papacy. Rome became a difficult place for the popes. After Clement V, formerly Archbishop of Bordeaux, became pope in the early 14th century, he refused to live in Rome and moved his court to Avignon. This, the Avignon papacy, was shocking for many Catholics, and it's referred to by some as the Babylon exile. Six more popes then resided in Avignon until 1377. In 1378, what's known as the Great Western Schism occurred. Partly at the urging of the medieval mystic Catherine of Siena, Gregory XI had returned to Rome. But subsequent popes in Rome were challenged by rival popes in Avignon, with each side calling the other antipope. It wasn't until 1417 that one pope in Rome, Martin V, was accepted by all sides. How diverse have popes been? For obvious reasons, given Rome's location, the largest number have been Italian. However, there have been lots of German and French popes too, as well as appointments from Poland, John Paul II, and Argentina, Francis. Only one from Britain, though Adrian IV, born Nicholas Breakspear, whose papacy lasted nearly 5 years, from 1154. Today, the Catholic Church is declining in Europe, but growing in Africa, South America, and Asia. So the Vatican is very keen that it's seen as much more global institution, not just Europe-centric. In the years before he died, Pope Francis appointed a lot of cardinals from countries that had not been represented before. A 13th century, or has there ever been a female pope? A 13th century account disseminated the legend of Pope Joan, who supposedly lived in the 9th century. She was described as a very able, talented woman who disguised herself as a man and rose through the ranks to become pope. She was found out only because she gave birth, supposedly during a papal ceremony. From the 16th century, though, historians of both a Protestant and a Catholic flavor looked at the story and concluded that it's extremely unlikely that she existed or that any of this happened. Even so, the fact that this was a very popular idea in the 13th century tells us something very interesting about how people at the time viewed women, that perhaps they were more progressive than we might imagine. At the moment, there's a lot of questioning about what roles should play in the church. Obviously, the members of the College of Cardinals are all men, but Pope Francis tried to get women into higher positions in the church and in the Vatican Curia. The Curia is the administrative body that helps the Pope govern the Catholic Church. The issue of women deacons is still bubbling under the surface at the moment, with some cardinals keener on that than others. So when people think about the legend of Pope Joan, they perhaps are thinking about ways in which they can widen the participation of women in the Catholic Church today. Matt Elton goes on and asks, what traits have been needed to make a great or successful pope? Rebecca Rist answers, tenacity, certainly. Take Alexander III, who had a very long pontificate in the mid-12th century. He had to contend with no fewer than four antipopes while he was in office. He kept being driven out of Rome, and yet he continued going. So that's really important quality for any pope, not being put off by your enemies and managing to keep going. Second, he got to be able to listen to his advisor. He doesn't have to be a great theologian, and he probably won't be, but he needs people around him who can guide him. He also needs figures in tune with popular sentiment and the zeitgeist. Third, he must have some kind of popular appeal and charisma. We're living in such a fast-moving environment today in terms of communication and getting the message across and trying to counter all sorts of other messages. But even in the 10th century, at the nadir of the papacy, a pope had to have charisma to get the Roman populace on side to acclaim him. He had to have that special quality. And finally, how much has the choice of pope mattered historically? It matters a lot, Rebecca Rist answers, particularly if they have a relatively long pontificate. It can affect the direction of travel, not just of the papacy, but also of the Catholic Church more widely. And that's why there was such a big furor in the media after Francis died about whether the next incumbent would be a traditional conservative pope or a liberal progressive pope. Different cardinals have different views about issues, such as the matter of women deacons, for example. So a pope's own views are very important, but so are the people who he surrounds himself with, in terms of advisors and theologians and so on. I've already mentioned that Pope Francis appointed some women to some of these leading positions in the Vatican Curia. We will see what the new pope, Leo the 14th, does in this regard. Our interviewer, Rebecca Rist, is a professor in medieval history at the University of Reading. Her books include Popes and Jews from 1095 to 1291, published by Oxford University Press in 2016. I'll now move to another interview, and this one is between York Membury, and Sir Keir Starmer. Freedom and democracy are not to be taken for granted. This statement was brought out in an interview between Sir Keir Starmer and our journalist, York Membury, to celebrate the 80th anniversary of VE, Victory in Europe Day, on May 5th, Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer hosted a tea party in Downing Street for Second World War veterans, schoolchildren, and people with links to the armed forces. Following the event, he spoke to our correspondent, York Membury, about why marking the anniversary is so important and the renaissance with the current war in Ukraine. York Membury starts out asking, why does the VE Day anniversary matter to you? The Prime Minister answers, it was an incredible occasion and a moment for all of us, myself included, to reflect and remember. It was a chance to have conversations with veterans and those who lived through the Second World War and to learn more about their stories. Every single conversation and every single veteran's experience is different. I spoke to a woman who had been outside the gates of Buckingham Palace on VE Day, chanting, "We want the king," and later doing the conga in the street. That gave me a real idea of the sense of jubilation on that day. It's also an opportunity to look back and remind ourselves that our children, my boy is 16 and my girl is 14, live in peace in a democracy because of the sacrifices of the Second World War generation. My grandfather was in the army during the war, though he was one of those people who never spoke about what he did and where he went, and he died when I was quite young. Having the Ukrainian contingent there in today's procession, which took place in London earlier on May 5th alongside an RAF flypast, was also incredibly powerful. It was heartwarming to see the spontaneous applause they received outside Buckingham Palace. It was also a reminder that while we're looking back after 80 years and rightly celebrating victory in Europe in 1945, the things we fought for, such as freedom and democracy, are not to be taken for granted. The importance of VE Day to me personally is wrapped up in all of those elements. York Membury asks, why does VE Day still matter to Britain today in 2025? The Prime Minister answers, firstly, because it's right that we are, as a nation, should remember the sacrifice people made at the time. And it was huge, huge sacrifice. Many of those who fought in the forces never came back. Secondly, it's a celebration of 80 years of peace. We had two world wars in a relatively short period, but a number of generations have been the beneficiaries of the peace dividend that followed victory in Europe. Thirdly, this anniversary is also a personal reminder of my responsibilities as Prime Minister for the safety of our country, which is the first duty of a Prime Minister, and, moreover, the responsibility that I have as Prime Minister to ensure that the peace we've enjoyed for 80 years continues for many decades to come. It's that which drives me in much of the work that I'm doing in the UK now and what I'm doing with the Ukraine. More broadly, do you think that it's right that we mark historical anniversaries? Prime Minister Starmer answers, I think it is, and the further we get from key historical events such as Victory in Europe Day, the more important it is to mark them, because more people alive now do not remember them. By celebrating VE Day and similar historical landmarks, we all better appreciate past sacrifices. We are an incredible country, and there is much to celebrate, where that's our remarkable achievements in the Second World War or other big moments in our history. Do you have any strong views about the teaching of history of the Second World War in schools today? Not particularly. My generation learned about it at school, and it's hardwired into our memory. But seeing my children learn about the Second World War for the first time has been quite inspiring. I think it's also important to try to look at the conflict through the eyes of ordinary men and women who served their country at the time, be it on the front line or by helping to keep the country going at home. Do you see any legacies of the Second World War in modern geopolitics? Yes, at the heart of the war in Ukraine are the values we were fighting for in the Second World War, such as sovereignty, safeguarding hard-won freedoms, and having the right to choose one's own security arrangements. So there are huge resonances with the past, and that's not necessarily a good thing. For many years after the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, I generally didn't think I would see tanks rolling over Europe, European borders again, let alone invasions and occupations in mainline Europe. Are we too fixated on the Second World War compared with other periods in Britain's history? Not really, because it was such a momentous moment in our story. The stakes were so high, and the outcome played such an important part in shaping the modern world. It's hugely important to keep alive the lessons learned from that conflict, to protect our values, defend our freedoms, and avoid repeating the horrors of the past. And Mr. Mayberry asks, are there any other lessons to be learned from VE Day? The Prime Minister responds, yes, it's a reminder of the value of forging alliances with fellow countries sharing broadly similar values to ourselves. We wouldn't have won the Second World War but for the help of our allies. Besides being a key member of NATO today, we've also played a major role in the creation of the Joint Expeditionary Force, established in 2014, supporting security and defense across the region. It is important to recognize that NATO has been a cornerstone of the peace for the past 80 years, and in many respects is one of the greatest alliances the world has ever seen. I am determined to make sure not just that it's something we look back on with pride, but that it continues to deliver for the decades to come. Lastly, VE Day is a reminder not just of the sacrifices made by veterans, but by the need for us as a country to do more to look after our veterans generally, hence our setting up of VALOR, a new UK-wide veteran support system. This will ensure that housing, employment, health, and welfare support is available for those who have gotten so much for their country. Our journalist for this conversation, York Membury, is a journalist and a regular contributor to BBC History magazine. You can read his latest My History Hero interview with Pauline Black OBE in this edition of the BBC History magazine. Our next article is a memory of Michael Wood. Michael Wood is a professor of public history at the University of Manchester. He has presented numerous BBC series. His books include The Story of China, published by Simon & Schuster in 2021. Place names are signposts to the past, and how revealing they are. I was recently back in Devon, long ago, on childhood holidays from the industrial north. This seemed to me the real England. Still today, a rusting cast iron signpost peeping through the foliage in a sunken lane gives me an inexplicable thrill. It's the idea that the deep past might still be touched and just around the corner. Place names are signposts to the past: Shumley, Walfardsworthy, Nimmet, Roland. What names and how revealing they are. Take Ipplepen, a village with Roman and Iron Age roots in the hills near Torquay. A recent dig here has turned up a small post-Roman cemetery in use till the 8th century and a Roman butcher's shop with coins and broken amphorae that once held olive oil, wine, and fish sauce imported from the Mediterranean. The name Impelpen was first recorded in the 10th century and contains a personal name that appears to be Roman, British, or Celtic, Elpelus or Epella, in a region where the Celtic pre-Welsh language may have died out only after 1066. The name of the pre-English landowner was, incredibly, passed down. In the home counties, ancient British or Welsh place names are mainly gone except for river names. Here they linger, from the Thames to smaller watercourses, such as the wonderfully named Rib, Bean, and Merrin, or Memram, in Herefordshire. Sometimes English newcomers didn't understand these words. Avon, of course, has the same derivative as Afron, Welsh for river. Braden Hill includes no fewer than three words with the same meaning. Bray is Welsh and Dun is Old English, both translating as hill. So, hill, hill, hill. Some place names tell of events. You can track the first phrase of Viking settlement in hybrid names such as Grimston, denoting an English settlement or village taken by Grin, a leading member of the great army that invaded Britain from 865. Then, with the second wave of migration, came the names ending in by, meaning farm, Grimsby, for example. Finally, there are the Thorpe names, meaning homestead, as in Scunthorpe. These names were left by third-wave immigrants who were forced to open up poor land on the fringes. Place names show how the dominant language takes over, in whichever way it happens. Across the world, the pattern was the same, especially in the age of imperialism. Think of the overlay of English names in Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, or the U.S. There are the indigenous inhabitants were wiped out or pushed into corners, yet place names associated with them still populate the landscape. From Alabama to Wyoming, take Michigan, which is Big Lake in the speech of the Ottawa tribe, or Mississippi, Big River in Algonquin. From Malibu to the Napa Valley, telltale signposts remain, despite ethnic cleansing by European settlers and colonialists. In Ireland, as recently as 2005, the Place Names Commission issued a list of 2,000 Gaelic equivalents to English place names. And, of course, people in power are still at it. Witness Donald Trump's renaming of the Gulf of Mexico. A revealing example is told in Sacred Landscape, 2002. A remarkable book by the Israeli writer, historian, and political scientist Miran Benvenusti. His father was an Israeli geographer on the Government Names Commission, tasked after 1948 with giving Palestinian villages and landscapes names linked to Israel's biblical homeland. New Hebrew place names, resonating with the biblical story of the Holy Land, replaced the Arabic names of more than 9,000 natural features, villages, and even ruins in the New Israel. Benvenisti's story shows firsthand how place names were used to help change an earlier Arab landscape into the modern Israeli state. Of course, such things have happened throughout history. Centuries after the Moors were expelled from Spain, today's tourists can still detect the contours of Muslim Spain, from the Alhambra to Granada's Zacatin, clothes sellers' street. Still a closed market, yet in Palestinian, returning now to his ancestral landscape after seven decades away, would often be hard pushed to identify the sites of his erstwhile home. The signposts are gone. The story Benvenisti tells is about a battle over the signposts of memory that are essential to all human beings. As the novelist Milan Kundera said, "The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting, often slowly, imperceptibly, over time, but sometimes at a stroke, history is erased. But but sometimes it still magically endures, even over millennia. People here have long memories, ask the folks in Eppelpin. Our next article is written by Kavita Puri on a groundbreaking museum initiative by the FA. You can book a one-on-one encounter with an Egyptian shoe. Kavita Puri is a journalist and broadcaster for BBC Radio 4. Her latest BBC Sounds podcast, Three Millennium, charts the 1943 Bengal famine and won gold in the new podcast category at the 2024 British Podcast Awards. Museums are magical places. They are the keepers of so many histories and stories from near and far. However, there's a large part of every museum that most people never see. Behind the scenes lies another world, one of conservation, upkeep, research, and the moving around of collections, perhaps for an exhibition or to loan to another museum. But what if you could walk around these areas in which objects are stored and restored? What if you could hold the object that you wanted to study or observe up close? That's now possible in the new B&A East Storehouse in Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in Stratford, East London. This huge space spanning four levels is home to some 250,000 objects and 350,000 books from the museum's collection. Its 1,000 archives document a diverse array of subjects, including the Glastonbury Festival and the world of theater and performance. Dotted throughout the building are 100 mini displays on topics ranging from resistance movements to the artistry of East London, charting how and why items are collected and preserved, and outlining the latest scholarship on their stories. They also explore the ways in which archives and collections are part of creative expression and understanding, and how we describe and contextualize the past. The workings of museum practice are made transparent here. As a trustee of the V&A, I have been watching this remarkable and ambitious project unfold across recent years. I've admired the extraordinary care taken in all aspects of the process, from the moving and installation of objects to consideration of how the visitor experience can be enhanced. The first object moved into the V&A East Storehouse was a very large installation. It's a significant example of brutalism. A two-story section of a masonette from Robin Hood Gardens. This housing estate in Poplar, East London, was completed in 1972 and demolished from 2017 as part of the redevelopment of the area. Now viewable from different angles and heights, the masonette is sure to provoke further debate about urbanism and the interplay between people and architecture. The last object to be brought to the site, meanwhile, was an 11-meter-wide backdrop by Pablo Picasso for the 1924 Ballet Russe production La Traîne Bleue. It's rarely been seen before because of its huge size and the fact that it weighs 350 kilograms. But a special gallery has been built in the storehouse to exhibit large textiles and stage exhibits such as this magnificent example. There are many other significant objects displayed here that will catch your breath. You can stand under the vast late 15th century Torreso ceiling, taken from the Palacio de Altamira near Toledo in Spain, and gaze up in wonder at its carved and gilded designs that nod to Islamic artistic tradition. And you can admire the marble arches of the Agra colonnade built in India in the mid-17th century during the Mughal period. Possibly the storehouse's most pioneering innovation, though, is its order and object service. Anyone can book a one-on-one encounter with an item from the collection, whether it's an ancient Egyptian shoe, a costume by performance artist Lee Bowery, a Japanese tea ceremony set, or a print by the pioneering designer Althea McNish. This concept is a world first, to be able to experience the materiality of an object, to touch or to see it close up, previously possible only for museum practitioners, is a game changer. It will shift the relationship between the audience and the collection, and it's hoped that it will also inspire creativity and encourage new questions. With the museum practice opened up for all to see, to witness, even to hold, this offers an entirely new way to be part of the magic. Our next article is entitled Swings and Roundabouts. It's written by John Winder. Dr. John Winder is a historian of modern Britain at the University of Liverpool. We all have childhood memories of playgrounds, but what does the evolution of outdoor play in Britain tell us about the experience of being young over the past 200 years? Author John Winder serves up a history of sand pits, bomb sites, and battles with cars. A pub might seem a strange place to begin a history of Britain's playgrounds. Yet in June 1858, Charles Dickens delivered a speech at the London Tavern in Bishopsgate Street that, he hoped, would transform the lives of children across the imperial capital. As the guests dined on seasoned delicacies and fine wines, Dickens gave an impassioned plea on behalf of the Playground and Recreation Society, an organization that had been established just a few months earlier with the express aim of providing playgrounds for poor children in populous places. To the accompaniment of music laid on by the band of the First Life Guards, the celebrated author extolled the benefits that having a playground near to their own dwellings where they knew their children would be safe conferred on parents. I venture to assert that there can be no physical health without play, and there can be no efficient and satisfactory work without play, that there can be no sound and wholesome thought without play, he declared. It was a powerful argument, and one to which Dickens' audience evidently listened, for by the end of the following year, the Recreation Grounds Act had made its way into law. Henceforth, local authorities across the land would be allowed to create and own playgrounds for children and young people. It marked a turning point in British children's access to play. Or did it? The new legislation and Dickens' high-profile support could have been a big bang moment for the playground movement in Britain, but despite the celebrity endorsement, political backing, and widespread publicity, by 1860 the Playground Society had collapsed in a heap. It had amassed considerable debts, largely from putting on extravagant fundraising dinners. More damningly still, it had failed to create a single space in which London's children could play. The movement was hardly in full swing elsewhere either. While dedicated play space was set aside in Salford and Manchester in the 1840s, unaccompanied children were barred from entering such city parks, notably Salstar Park and Bradford, altogether. This sorry Dickensian tale contrasts starkly with the state of play in modern Britain. Fast forward to 2025, and you'll find more than 26,000 children's playgrounds in cities, towns, and villages across the UK. And while the best efforts of Britain's great novelists failed to save the Playground Society from financial disaster, today more than £85 million pounds is spent on maintaining playgrounds each and every year. No one's arguing that playground provision in modern Britain is perfect. Far from it. In fact, it's a live debate as to whether playgrounds remain the best places for our children to be playing in the 21st century city at all. However, one thing can't be doubted, And that's that. To tell the story of the British playground is also to shine a light on what it's meant to be a child in this country over the past 200 years. Of course, child's play didn't begin with the Victorians. Archaeologists have discovered rag balls from ancient Egypt and sculptures of playing children from ancient Greece. Pietro Bruegel, the Elder's remarkable children's games, published in 1560, depicts more than 200 children playing in 80 different ways. We know that most Victorian working-class children played outside, often in the streets close to home. Although children and their families faced many difficulties at this time, including overcrowding, pollution, and disease, finding places to play and friends to play was rarely an issue. As more children spent their day in education rather than work, there was also more time to play after school, too. And yet, social elites and urban reformers increasingly imagined the street as a bad place to play, long before cars were common on British roads. For William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, poor city children had a miserable subsistence, and their play was curtailed to the running gutter. For housing reformer Octavia Hill, children learnt lessons of evil while playing in the streets and alleys. In response to the growing sense of disquiet, the elaborately named Metropolitan Public Garden, Boulevard, and Playground Association was founded in 1882 and became the leading advocate for children's playgrounds in the late 19th century. But could it succeed where the Playground Society had failed? The association was concerned by the pale faces, stunted figures, debilitated forms, narrow chests, and all the outward signs of a low vital power that it saw in urban working-class children. To address these alleged physical imperfections, it set out to create a children's playground divided into two portions, one for boys and one for girls, both supplied with a gymnastics apparatus within a quarter of a mile of every working-class home. Strong and healthy children would, after all, create more effective and efficient factory workers, soldiers, and sailors. By the early 1890s, the association had spent more than £14 million in today's money on upwards of 50 open spaces, including 20 with children's gymnasiums. In Southwark, Little Dorrit's Playground, named after the eponymous star of one of Charles Dickens' most celebrated novels, cost the equivalent of £2.4 million to buy and kit out. Such spaces bore little resemblance to the playgrounds we know today. The separate areas for boys and girls reflected the inequitable gender norms of the time, and they were fitted with equipment that we would probably associate with Olympic gymnastics, including parallel bars, vaulting horses, and gymnastic rings. At Spa Fields Playground in Cluckenwell, a large gravel area doubled as a parade ground for local army reservists. Whatever the expectations of adults, children seem to have enjoyed using such spaces. On a visit to a playground in 1896, the campaigner Isabella Holmes described a boy whose clothes were literally dropping to pieces, and he twisted himself about on the handle swings, putting his toes through the handles and performing all sorts of gyrations which many a well-fed boy, clad in the best of flannels, would have given his all to be able to accomplish. While children had been busy playing, by the early 20th century, adult attitudes to playground design were beginning to change. For the author, Ansley Kennelly, writing in 1907, the pitiless, meager surroundings of most children's gymnasiums did little to protect children from the unwholesome sights and sounds of a sordid, huckstering, fetid slum street. Better playgrounds were needed. Such calls coincided with concerns during the First World War about unfit conscripts and juvenile delinquency on the home front. Wartime investigations into the health and well-being of mothers and children concluded that a playground close to home was essential for a child's proper physical and moral development. Voluntary organizations, philanthropists, municipal park departments, and commercial mark manufacturers all responded enthusiastically in the interwar period. The National Playing Fields Association became an important advocate and funder of children's playgrounds across the country. With King George V as its patron and regular funding appeals on BBC Radio, the NPFA had considerable success in promoting the playground cause. This cause was given greater urgency by the growing number of children being killed by cars. In fact, such was the death toll that street play was increasingly regarded as unacceptable. One coroner investigating the death of three toddlers observed that it was not fair to drivers that parents should allow their children to play in the street. The NPFA even campaigned against the temporary closure of streets to enable safer play, preferring instead to encourage children into playgrounds. By the 1930s, there were nearly 50 playgrounds managed by the London Country Council in the capital, with 26 in Manchester and many more elsewhere. The burgeoning demand for equipment saw manufacturing companies adapt their production lines. The entrepreneur and inventor who had the greater impact on this development was Charles Wicksteed. On the back of earlier commercial success, Wicksteed created a public park in his hometown of Kettering in Northamptonshire. Disappointed that so few children visited, he decided to make it a more exciting place to play. And so he designed a raft of products inspired by Edwardian amusement park rides in Green Yarmouth and Blackpool. These included the Joy Wheel, an early roundabout, the Jazz Swing, commonly known as a plank swing today, the Ocean Wave, Witch's Hat, and large wooden slides. A progressive liberal, Wicksteed hoped to create healthy, happy, and free childhoods. Girls and boys, children and adults, were all welcome to play together in the Wicksteed Park playground. Writing in 1929, he suggested that the poor little gutter children, with all their hardships, playing with mud and freedom, are far happier than many well-to-do children under the perfect control and sad dullness and weariness of a too much or ordered life. His playground equipment was designed to be so robust that children could play with it however they liked. And we're not just talking British children. Soon, municipalities from across the globe were placing orders with the Northamptonshire entrepreneur. In fact, by the late 1930s, Wicksteed's company had equipped more than 4,000 playgrounds, from some South Africa to Hong Kong and Venezuela to the tiny South Atlantic island of St. Helena. Wicksteed's advocacy and wider shifts in social values meant that few playgrounds were segregated by gender by the late 1930s, but playgrounds now look the same, no matter where they were in the world. Back in Britain, swings, slides, and roundabouts became an essential feature of efforts to redevelop British towns and cities in the mid-20th century. Slum clearance schemes, including those in Carroll Gardens and Liverpool and Quarry Hill in Leeds, positioned the playground at the center of new blocks of flats. Sites requisitioned or damaged during the Second World War were also put back into playful use. Paddington Recreation Ground had been repurposed as a municipal piggery during the war, producing more than 300 tons of meat. It was reopened in 1948 by Field Marshal Montgomery with manufactured play equipment, a paddling pool, and a sandpit. Town planners working on Plymouth's reconstruction designed a network of more than 100 playgrounds in public parks and on bomb-damaged sites across the city. The playground explosion may have been a big hit with children, but to many adults, it was a little dull. In fact, in the eyes of some commentators, Britain's new wave of standardized playgrounds, with their uniform climbing frames and stark tarmac surfaces, were as bleak as barrack squares and just as boring. A post-war movement of progressive educationalists, landscape architects, and artists, headed by Lady Allen of Hertwood, envisioned a more fulfilling future for Britain's outdoor play spaces. And it was one that promoted creativity, self-expression, and contact with the natural world. As an experiment, bomb sites were converted into adventurous playgrounds so that children could build with scrap materials, dig in the mud, nurse fires, and tend small gardens. Sculptures, decommissioned steamrollers, and immobilized trucks were meant to inspire make-believe. Commando playgrounds incorporated tree trunks, suspended tires, and concrete pipes to provide not only a free and varied outlet for energy, but a spur to imagination and invention. Landscape playgrounds had undulations, banks, trees, and bushes as a more naturalistic setting for creative play. In a handful of cities, traffic playgrounds provided playful amusement and taught children about road safety. Children's responses to these play spaces were seldom recorded. Instead, we must look to the work of sociologists in the 1960s and 70s to get a sense of how playgrounds were used. One study of nearly 6,000 children found that swings and roundabouts primarily acted as a meeting point for friends and playmates, who then went on to play beyond the playground. Another study showed that more children preferred sandpits and paddling pools over manufactured equipment. These doubts about the value of playground were reinforced by events in the later 20th century. Funding cuts meant that local authorities increasingly found it difficult to maintain play spaces. In 1973, Colin James, the Bishop of Stepney, felt that many councils had got their priorities badly wrong, suggesting that it's not through malice or evil intent, I am sure, but they have been overtaken by the motor car and other matters, so that play provision has been left behind. In the 1980s and 90s, as social housing and state-run industries were privatized, the children's playground remained a publicly owned and community-funded place for play, although not without its share of problems. Tabloid and broadsheet newspapers reported on the risk of parasitic infections from the snapping pincers of Toxocara canis, dog roundworm, and the threat posed by pedophiles. Further funding cuts meant that many playgrounds became derelict, with the journal Playtimes even running a monthly award for the worst playground in the country. National government has rarely been interested in play provision, but in 2008, £235 million was allocated to local authorities across England to improve playground provision. Accompanying guidance called Design for Play encouraged councils and designers to think more creatively about play provision. However, the implementation of policies of austerity from 2010 saw funding and guidance withdrawn. Despite periods of neglect, the playground remains an everyday feature of British urban life. This is hardly a surprise given our almost universal and often nostalgic experience of using them. Children still enjoy digging in sandpits, the rhythm of the swings, and the trepidation of scaling tall climbing structures. But we must not let this nostalgia mask problems with the playground concept. As the campaign group Make Space for Girls has shown, there is still much to do to ensure public spaces are welcoming to all children. The obsession with playgrounds, often tucked away in the corner of a park, might even be seen as a distraction from wider efforts to create child-friendly towns and cities in which children rather than cars dominate our streets. The long history of playground helps us to understand how we arrived in the present, but it should not stand in the way of efforts to create inclusion and humane urban environments for the future. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Kathy Miller with Historical View. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.